Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker. Today's World Cup special is sponsored by Sporting Index. My name is Thomas Rooney and I'm delighted to be joined by Sam Long, the Arse Fans editor. How's it going, Sam?
Very well, thank you, Thomas.
Excellent. And once again, we've got Mohammed Butt, the chief writer at Squawker. How's it going, Mo?
It's fantastic to be back. Very happy. World Cup, still going on. It's brilliant.
Excellent. And then we've also got Ed Fulton from Sporting Index. How's it going, Ed? Good to have you with us.
Good, thank you. Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's terrific.
We've obviously got lots to talk about today. We're going to talk about England versus Panama in a second. But just before we do, Ed, could you maybe just give us a little bit about Sporting Index and sort of what you guys are doing during the World Cup, and if there's a particular promotion you think our listeners would be interested in?
Yeah, sure. Well, to anyone who doesn't know what spread betting is, it's very simple. It's a buying and selling option. It's a two-way market, so we can't hide. We have to be right. If you think we're too defensive, you can attack us and vice versa. It's all about margins with us. So the more you're right, the more you win. And obviously, I have to say, for compliance reasons, the more you're wrong, the more you lose. But yeah, and for those who have never done it before, we're offering a promotion which is £50 to play around with for a week. Mm-hmm. Anything you win, you keep, and anything up to £50 you lose, we'll cover. Mm-hmm. So it's a little sort of playground, muck around in a few games in the World Cup, see how you do, get a feel for things, and then take us on.
Absolutely. The World Cup's perfect for that sort of promotion, to be fair, isn't it? Games every day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm told we are opening a lot of accounts every day, which is good news. Yeah. It is. I think I said off air, but this is the World Cups are the busiest we get. Mm. Old clients who haven't bet with us for a while reappear, new ones appear, and the regulars are even busier than usual. So, yeah, it's a good time.
Absolutely. Everyone's kind of got World Cup fever, haven't they? Good for everybody.
And England's in the tournament, so there we go.
Absolutely. And on that note, obviously, England won their first game. They've got Panama this weekend, and we're going to kick off talking basically about that. We'll obviously look back at the first game a little bit as well. But Sam, I don't know if I can start with you in terms of for England versus Panama. Obviously, England overwhelming favourites. But is there any particular changes you think Southgate should make to the 11? Should anyone be rested? Is anyone in danger of being dropped? What are you thinking?
I mean, it sounds like we've got a pretty clean bill of health injury-wise, apart from Dele Alli, who looked like he was injured from about 10 minutes in. Mm. Not sure why they didn't sort of take him off. He was obviously convinced that he was fit enough to continue. So I think the big one with Alli potentially not being fit is Ruben Loftus-Cheek. He looked very, very good when he came on, sort of 10 minutes. Added a real drive to the England midfield. And I think he's probably going to get the nod if Alli isn't fit.
Mm-hmm. Do you think? Yeah, he came out, certainly made a good impact, Mo. Do you think Loftus-Cheek would be the one to replace Alli?
You had to have a look at the way he played when he came on. Absolutely filled in that sort of daily role perfectly, moving between the lines, playing out in the half space. Generally, just being comfortable, being the creative outlet for the team, being the creative fulcrum for the team. Like, that was the thing with Dele. For so long, he looked like he was sort of England's Thomas Muller, like sort of forward who, yeah, he could create a little bit, but he was mostly a goal scorer. But last season, he's really evolved his game. He's become more comfortable taking on a playmaking role. And him and Jesse Lingard, having him and Jesse Lingard at the heart of what are ostensibly central midfield positions is why England looks so good, because they're both such dynamic and mobile players. And Lingard is always best playing off people, so you need someone else to take control of the ball and be the main guy, and that's what Dele did. And I think Loftus-Cheek showed in his small cameo that he's more than comfortable in playing that role, taking control. And I think he's also capable technically and tactically capable of doing that. And I would expect, even if Dele is like 75% fit, there's no need for him to take the risk. Panama is the easiest game in the group by a mile. Belgium is coming up. Belgium is going to be a difficult game. You rest Dele. I would expect that there'll be more changes. I wouldn't expect just Dele will get out. I think maybe Sterling will get dropped, although I wouldn't start him. I would start him trying to get him going against Panama, but I can see how Southgate would think, okay, let's get Rashford going. I expect Ashley Young might get rested. We'll see Danny Rose, see if Danny Rose can take that spot from him. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll see Eric Dier play just to get him fresh, because I think Henderson's a better fit for Panama, because Panama aren't going to attack so much. You want Henderson's ball playing. But I can see how, with Belgium coming, with bigger teams coming, maybe you want to get Dier in a bit of rhythm.
Absolutely. And Ed, did you obviously enjoy the first game at all? And any changes you'd make for the Panama game, and what you thought about the performance in general?
Yeah, well, it was a little uncomfortable, actually, because obviously any late England winner is always going to be a shocking result for us. And the guy, the trader, we were looking at a decent profit, and then it goes in. He's got his head in his hands. And unfortunately, a few of our traders had a good cheer at it, which doesn't always get down well. But it's England in the World Cup, so you can kind of forgive it. I kind of come at this from a fairly layman's point of view. Rugby's more my thing. So when I watch football, I tend to ask people's opinion, and then I get, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, and talking to the football boys, it seems Trippier and Loftus-Cheek are the two that they want to see.
Yeah.
We've gone this far. We haven't mentioned Sterling yet. Now, I know he's had a good season. To me, he looks so uncomfortable when he's stopped and has to think about what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, a bit like Theo Walcott years ago, when he did instinctively, you know, played and shot or did whatever, that's fine. The second he comes to a halt, so presumably that's what Panama are going to do. They're going to just, they sort of did it a bit against Belgium, I think. They're going to, you know, press everyone, to get physical with them, nudge him. And to me, if Sterling plays, he's probably going to have another poor game if that's how he plays.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Mo mentioned it a minute ago in terms of what you do with Sterling for this one, Sam. Do you think, because I mean, I've got here that England managed 6 shots on target in the first half versus Tunisia, which was more than any other 2018 World Cup team in the first 45 minutes so far. So England were creating the chances, and for confidence point of view, it'd be nice if Sterling got on the end of one of them and stuck him in, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think I've seen quite a few people sort of bring up Sterling's poor goal record for England. And I think it's
2015, isn't it? Last time he scored, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely a long time. But I think it's perhaps a bit unfair, I think, to start bringing that into the equation now that the tournament's up and running. We weren't saying that when he looked really good against Nigeria in the warm-up. No one was sort of saying, oh, we scored two goals. But with that said, I think I'd like to see Rashford start against Panama ahead of Sterling, because I think with the formation in the first game, it was almost like Sterling was playing as a second striker, and then Ali and Lingard behind were almost sort of taking up that space that he wanted to operate in just behind Kane.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if Sterling's going to be pushed that far forward anyway, then we may as well play a second striker,
mm-hmm.
especially against Panama, where it's going to be really sort of tight and compact. They played the back five the other day against Belgium. I would like to see Rashford start, because I think he's going to be a really important player if we do go into the latter rounds of the tournament. Then I don't want to be bringing him on for his first minutes in, say, the quarter final. I'm an advocate of making the small sort of tweaks while we can. It's a big advantage, I think, to be going into the second game and saying we can make the changes.
Yeah, because if we'd have drawn the first game, it would obviously be a different conversation, wouldn't it, if we hadn't got that late winner.
Yeah.
But it just frees us up to maybe give these players some minutes and hopefully get some confidence.
I mean, there is the goal difference aspect as well, which,
true.
You know, this is
of course, yeah.
It could come down, you know, even a draw against Belgium might, in the end, not be enough. So we've got them 2 goal favourites, and they're going to have to make sure they cover that at least.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be looking to get 3 or 4 just so they've got that insurance if it does get tight against Belgium in the last game.
Absolutely. And just quickly on the price of England, has it developed in the outright markets, or sort of is a lot of people getting optimistic after the first game?
Yeah, it's shortened up. I mean, on the 100 index, which is 100 for winning and 75 for losing, we've got them now at 33.5, 36,
mm-hmm.
which is up a few. Germany's obviously gone down a bit because they lost their first game, so there's been a bit of adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
But England were a bigger price for this tournament than they've been for a World Cup for a long time. And in a tournament where there isn't as yet an outstanding side, there are boys in the office who are the most cynical out there when it comes to England, who actually are making a case that England might be some sort of value in this tournament. Because, I mean, you know, you just got to get in knockout stages and then you're 3 games away.
Well, yeah, I mean, if the country's going to go crazy, if we get to the quarterfinals or something,
yeah.
I mean, we've won one game against Tunisia and everyone's going insane. It's just really World Cup fever's here.
I think what's fed into that optimism is that a lot of the big teams haven't started well. Usually after the first round of games, there's 2 or 3 teams who you sort of pick out and say they're going to be there or thereabouts, where, you know, the likes of Germany, Argentina have sort of stumbled in their first games, and it's maybe got people believing that this could be the year that a sort of second-tier nation like, well, England or Mexico could reach the latter stages.
I mean, it's definitely possible, but you look at it this way. I mean, really, only Spain have looked really good this tournament so far. Spain look really good. No one else has really looked good. You figure Brazil will come good eventually because they've got so much outstanding talent. Germany, as I said before the tournament, Germany have fundamental problems. I don't know if they'll be able to cover for them, because I don't think Lowe has taken a particularly good squad there, not about Sane, but about other midfield options. I don't think he's taken to cover that. Argentina are just a mess. They've been a mess for a long time. Messi's been dragging them through games. And last World Cup he had Mascherano's help. This World Cup it's just Messi, because Mascherano is past it, well past it. And you can, yeah, he's old, he's playing in China now, and you can see the difference that you know, Argentina just have nothing. If they'd had more time with Sampaoli, maybe they'd be able to do something. But without him, I don't know. Mexico looked really organised behind Spain. Mexico looked really good, and England looked really good. So I mean, like the boys are saying, that's, you know, apart from Spain, England look as good as anyone else in the tournament has so far. But that's the important thing, so far, because Brazil have got so much talent in that team. If they just start to suddenly click, I mean, remember Switzerland kicked them off the park. So unless you do that, and unless the referee lets you do that, that's the important thing. Anyone can be physical, but can you be physical and get away with it?
Well, it's a really interesting point, actually, because we do a bookings market for the entire tournament, and we were looking at about 39 points, 10 free yellows. So we were expecting about 4 yellows a game, and it's coming in at about 2.9,
right.
A whole yellow card less. Now, some of the challenges, automatic bookings, certainly in La Liga and the Premiership, they're just being waved off.
Mm-hmm.
There was one the other day, was it Senegal? Yesterday, Senegal-Poland, whenever the Senegal-Poland game was, and the guy went down the box, and that's either a booking for simulation, or it's a penalty and a booking. Nothing.
Mm.
So I think the referees in this tournament have been told by FIFA, there's been some edict, let the game flow, which actually, to your point, brings other smaller teams into it, because you can be more physical. You're not going to get that early booking. You'll get 2 or 3 chances. Mm. And we've dropped our bookings price by 200 points. So anyone who sold at the beginning of the tournament is already sitting on a handsome profit. And there's nothing to suggest that they're going to change that. So if you're allowed to be more physical and you can use technical fouls and not be booked for that, that could have a major impact on how this tournament unfolds.
Absolutely. And talking of being physical, you'd expect Panama to be this weekend against England. I don't know, Mo, what do you think people can expect from Panama, and what did you make of their performance against Belgium? They stuck in there for a while, but then there was only really one winner, wasn't there?
I mean, they worked hard. They were game and they defended deep and they were organised, but ultimately, you know, there wasn't too much quality there. Like Marco Murillo, the right back, had an incredible chance to equalise. I mean, look, this is the first thing we should say. They were undone by a moment of pure genius from Dries Mertens, right? Mm. Belgium did not look like scoring. And it took, in fact, it took 2 moments of genius to undo them. De Bruyne's wonderful outside the foot cross to Lukaku, and then also Dries Mertens' amazing goal. So, you know, they only gave up an open look, which was the Lukaku goal, after that. So when they were 2-0 down, then they started throwing bodies forward. But, you know, Michael Murillo missed that great chance, 1-1, could have made it 1-1, and then who knows what happens, really. Look, they'll defend well. Their quality, they don't have the same kind of quality that England will, but this is the thing with England. Is I think they could do as Tunisia did. They could stifle England a bit in open play. If unless England score an early goal, they could stifle England because they have that ability. But unlike Tunisia, I mean, I think if England score, I don't think they'll have what it takes going forward to nick something. And more importantly, what England have that Belgium didn't have, because they didn't start Fellaini, didn't bring him on, is they have Harry Maguire on set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as we saw against Tunisia, that is an incredible weapon. And I think England's positive play, England's attacking play, will by its nature generate corners and, you know, set pieces, right? Set pieces at times. So, but with the fullbacks, Young and Young Trippier, or just Trippier if Young is rested, taking set pieces, and with Harry Maguire and John Stones in there, and with the way that England have clearly set out planned set piece routines, that, like, Panama's ability to sort of shut down England just by being physical and knocking them out, maybe conceding fouls and corners up, isn't going to work, because England now have, and that's how they beat Tunisia. The goals of Tunisia were both from set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's, England have a viable different route to goals. I think even as much as Panama would like to be physical and robust in defence, they're going to have to maybe actually try and do something a bit more expansive, because I don't think that's going to work against England.
It's interesting you say about set pieces, because I think in Panama's first game against Belgium, there was a couple instances where they got caught short. Belgium took a quick corner, quick throw-ins. They seemed to sort of just be switched off.
Mm.
And that's an area that England could really exploit if England are sort of at the races early on. Yes, they're going to be organised, and they deserve credit for keeping Belgium out till almost the hour mark, but they can definitely be got at. There was big nerves on show from them.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, it's their first World Cup. They're just desperate to score a goal. So they're going to be coming out to play at some point, I would suspect.
Yeah, you can expect wild celebrations if they get a goal, I think. And I think along with Iceland, they are one of 2 teams appearing for the World Cup finals for the first time. Mm. Ed, are you expecting any danger from them for England, or is any money going to Panama?
No, I think all the money, as the game approaches, will be for England. Mm-hmm. That tends to be the way punters go. I don't think you saw enough of them against Belgium, other than they were quite physical.
Yeah.
And they tried to stop Belgium playing. They actually woke Belgium up, it seemed to me. Mm. Belgium started quite lackadaisically and stuff. So if you want to get with England, I would get on early. Mm-hmm. And then by kickoff, I imagine the price will be 2.2 goals, something like, rather than two. And realistically, as you said, how many goals are Panama in for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they going to nick one? You know, I think Tunisia had a good shot on target until the
penalty.
Whatever you feel about that, but and I think most people say Tunisia are far better side than Panama. So, you know, it's a difficult one for them. So,
and just as we mentioned there about Panama in terms of the physicality, I've got, I think, Panama defender Roman Torres at 99 kg is officially listed as the heaviest player at the 2018 World Cup.
Unit.
So, yeah, so he might get stuck into to England's front line.
Yeah, well, I mean Harry Kane's already spent a match being wrestled to the ground and stuff. So I think maybe he's
just out of his weight division this time.
Yeah.
just finally on England Panama, I don't know if I can push each of you for a prediction. Sam, we'll start with you. You think it'll be a comfortable England win?
I will go for 2-0 England.
And Ed?
3-0.
Mo?
Yeah, I would also say 3-0 England. Marcus Rashford to score one of them.
Excellent. That's England versus Panama this Sunday. Okay, next up, we're just going to have a bit of a wider World Cup chat for a few minutes. Obviously, been plenty of action so far in the World Cup, Ed. And we mentioned briefly about Germany earlier. I don't know if their price has moved, obviously, after losing their first game. I think they would become the third consecutive defending champions to fail to reach the knockout stages.
Yeah, I saw that in your release, and I thought, fantastic stat. And yeah. You forget that. You have to go back, and you always presume the big boys are going to cruise through. But you lose your first game, and you're in all sorts of trouble. I mean, on a 100 index, we've still got Germany 28-31. So we still think they're going to get beyond the quarters,
mm-hmm.
between the quarters and the semis. So we haven't overreacted, but obviously you have to drop Germany 2 or 3 points. And based on the performance you saw, they did look, and I know some of the other contributors here are not fans of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And our boys in the office were saying that they didn't fancy them before the tournament either. So that's coming true, and punters see that, and they're... So we're taking a defensive position with Germany, but if you do think class will tell eventually, then they're probably a bit of value now to buy. But
yeah. Mo, you've mentioned quite a bit about Germany and their failings. Do you think is it a bit of an attitude problem? People mentioned about, I think Ozil's been criticised by former players about his...
I mean, Ozil's always criticised. I mean, the man raced 50 yards back to cover his own goal. I mean, you know, what more do you want from a guy? Like, you know, he's not going to make the tackle. He's a... forward, he's an elegant forward. He's not going to come back and make a life-saving tackle. The fact that he was even there to do it was impressive enough. It's easy. Ozil's an easy target because he's a very sort of languid playmaker, but it's not his fault. The problem, Germany's problem, is overwhelmingly in the centre of midfield and in defence. Defence is partly just because Boateng has been injured all the time. He's not nowhere near as good as he was 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Hummels is also nowhere near as good as he was 4 years ago. The mad thing is they have two excellent centre-halves in the squad. Nicolas Schüller and Antonio Rüdiger had amazing seasons. They should both be starting. Like, why aren't they starting? That's just mad. But the real big problem for Germany, I mean, that's a problem, but you can get away with that. The real problem is in midfield, because when they won the World Cup, right, they had Toni Kroos playing ahead of Sami Khedira and Bastian Schweinsteiger. I've spoken about this before. That was a really good midfield three, because Khedira was the workhorse, was the lungs. Schweinsteiger held midfield, positioning very intelligent, off the charts, and just was a brilliant footballer. And Kroos played ahead of them, could run forward. Kroos is a bad defender. He's a brilliant passer, so he could just focus on passing, mm-hmm. and killing people. He was the main architect of the 7-1, for instance, because Schweinsteiger just sat there. And repeatedly, how many of the goals were Kroos and Khedira just bombing forward? Because they could do that. And this, now Schweinsteiger's gone, right? And Khedira is 4 years older and much less effective than he was. And so Toni Kroos is still brilliant. Toni Kroos is probably better now than he was then. But... you know, he's one guy. He's not a good defender. And now he's playing at the base of midfield.
Absolutely. He's had a long season as well.
Yeah, he's had a long season, but he's had a long 3 seasons. Real Madrid gone deep in the Champions League 3 years in a row. But it's more the fact that he's not a defender. He can't play at the base of midfield. Not really. Like, for when you watch, if you watch Real Madrid play, part of the reason Rafa Benitez got the sack, for instance, is because he was forced by Perez to play Modric and Kroos to base midfield, and there's only so much Modric can cover for Kroos. Zidane was allowed to bring Casemiro in, that alleviated it somewhat, but it's still the same problem, because Casemiro is a tackler, can't really cover space. Kroos can't really cover space. Modric is brilliant, probably best central midfielder in the world. Like, he can't do it all himself. He's one guy. Yeah. So, and now you see that for Germany as well. Kroos can't cover space behind him. Khedira doesn't have the energy or the legs to do it anymore like he used to. And as a result, like, Germany are wide open. People are able to get at Hummels and Boateng very easily. Mexico tore through them like butter. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like they weren't even there. I mean, and that's, as much as we like to laugh at Hummels getting slipped, put on his backside on the halfway line, and believe me, that was hilarious. Why was he having to push up that high anyway? Where the hell were Khedira and Kroos? Why weren't they dealing with Javier Hernandez?
Yeah, so it's midfield, like you say.
It's midfield. And because, as I said, I don't know that he's taken anyone in the squad that can do that job. The Sebastian Rudy would be the only shout, maybe. But it's weird. Everyone was so worried about Germany missing Philipp Lahm that no one really realised they missed Bastian Schweinsteiger more. They don't have anyone that can do that job. Not to that level. So I don't know what Germany are going to do, really. But it's tricky.
And Sam, why do you think it is that the holders have struggled? So obviously Italy and Spain previously going to the next tournament. Is it because the coach maybe picks players on reputation and therefore aren't the best players in form, and because they've won the World Cup previously? Is that partly to do with it? Or do you think it's literally a coincidence that it's happened three times in a row?
Yeah, I'd probably say maybe it's more three times in a row. I'd probably say more of a coincidence, really. I certainly wouldn't say that Germany would be going into this sort of being overconfident or arrogant. I just think they got blown away by Mexico. Like Mo says, Khedira was way off the pace, looked so leggy. Like, Germany, they've got so many caps in their team, but they sort of looked their age. Mm. They just didn't have any answers for Mexico's just the raw sort of pace. And I think for Germany, even if they do get through the group, Mexico's have created that blueprint that other teams could sort of follow of how you beat this German team.
I mean, yeah, a better team than Mexico would have smashed them. Germany, Mexico,
countless chances, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, if Mexico had made better decisions in the final third, they would have won like 4-5-0. It would have been like the Spain-Netherlands game. So I think a better counter-attacking side that makes better decisions would absolutely destroy Germany. But you know what? It's happened four times in the last five world champions out of the group stages. Mm. France 2002, Italy 2010, and then Spain 2014. So it's happened three times out of the last five. So it's a real thing. And Brazil, who's the other defending champions, they got knocked out in the quarterfinals. Mm. So defending champions haven't had a good go of it since 1998, when Brazil defending champions got back to the finals. So it's not looking good for Germany. Defending your world title is hard, man. Yeah. 4 years after you do it, to do it again, to have evolved enough to stay fresh but still stay true to identity, it's not easy to do that. I mean, Spain possibly could have done had they made the correct squad choices 4 years ago. They didn't make the right squad choices. And again, it's the same thing. Germany haven't made the correct squad choices. Come here with a squad that was too much. Oh, we want it. We want it. We're with these lads. We'll go again with these lads. And you can't do that. You need to inject. You need to evolve. And that's why Spain now, for instance, look really good, because they have evolved. They brought new guys in. They've got Isco. They've got Koke. You know, they've got David De Gea in goal. You know, they're actually pushing forward. And I think for whoever wins this World Cup, whoever it is, needs to start planning now for defending the title in 4 years, and you start bringing guys to your squad, younger guys, you know, unless England win it, in which case England have a young enough squad that it basically is going to just go to the next World Cup.
I do think, with all that said, I do think Germany are still going to go through. They've got Sweden next, who I wasn't too impressed with. Yeah. And then, obviously, Mexico have got South Korea. So, South Korea could be out. And Germany are playing a team in the last game that are out. So I still think Germany are going to get through. And I certainly wouldn't be betting against them reaching the latter stages, because they're the Germans and they're going to come back again.
It's just the case that Germany lose one game and we all get a bit carried away that maybe they're not like the team we all aspire to be. Just quickly on away from Germany, Ed, you mentioned Brazil before. There's a lot of people still back in there, because obviously it's obviously 1-1 draw, but most people haven't got carried away with, you know, Brazil aren't going to make the latter stages like we have with Germany, even though they only drew. So Brazil still being heavily backed, do you think?
Not really. Actually, punters are kind of giving Brazil a swerve. They're not selling them. They're not buying them. There's a neutral quality to them. They're taking up a chunk of the market, and they are favourites, just ahead of Spain and Belgium. But you get a sense that punters are going to take a watching brief for the moment. See how they play in the next game. But they were quiet before the tournament in terms of.
Is that simply because they're the favourites and people just don't want to touch it? Or?
Yeah, well, I think it's what we talked about earlier. There's so many teams that have got a chance in this one. Mm-hmm. You'd rather take two or three teams at much bigger prices, put together a sort of Mexico, Serbia, Croatia package, mm-hmm. and rather than take a short price team, a Germany or a Brazil, and Lampong, because there was no consensus. You know, the Racing Post do a preview, Sporting Life website. Mm-hmm. None of them came out and you felt, right, it's Spain or it's Germany. It's, we've done the analysis and these
are the contenders. Yeah,
everyone had a different opinion.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it such an interesting World Cup. It may still pan out as a Germany-Brazil final with, you know, mm-hmm. the Belgians being somewhere about. But at the moment, I think we could be on the verge of a breakthrough in terms of a lesser-run team winning it.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, Pelé always talked about an African side winning it soon later. Maybe Senegal, who knows? But, you know, there are teams out there who look very comfortable competing with the big boys so far.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Senegal there. I wanted to move on slightly to Group H, which is quite significant for England, because I think they play either the winners or the runners-up of that group. And originally we said in a previous discussion that it's going to be Poland or Colombia.
Well,
at the moment, it's Japan and Senegal are the top two. So.
It looks like Colombia were going to win the group. They look like the best team, obviously. They weren't in the best form, but you thought they had the best players. Yeah. James Rodriguez, that's surely going to help. And then I thought Senegal would finish second. Mm-hmm. I thought they would surprise a lot of people. And they did. They were excellent. fully deserved their win against Poland. Absolutely. Played them off the park, really, from start to finish. They were organised defensively. They counter-attacked at speed. They moved the ball with intelligence. Sadio Mane was a fantastic attacking fulcrum for them. They took the chances. They got a bit luck with the opening goal. But, you know, they were better side. Poland were vastly devoid of imagination, which is what happens, I suppose, when you... All your excellence is in your central midfield, your defence, and then your striker. You don't have any wingers or any real credit. I mean, they've got Grzycki, but unless he's really balling, they don't really have enough sort of spark in the final third. So I'm not surprised that Senegal won. I'm very surprised Colombia lost. That was really weird.
And I think, the red card, obviously.
It massively conditioned the game. I mean, look, it was a long ball. Davinson Sanchez should have cleared it. For some reason, he didn't start Yerry Mina next to Davinson Sanchez. Now, Yerry Mina has not had the best of seasons since moving to Barcelona. He struggled, but he has a good partnership with Davinson Sanchez, and more importantly, he has the kind of pace that would allow him to get around and cover when Sanchez made that mistake. And his replacement, Barros, did not have the pace to do that covering, and as a result, shot comes in, Ospina saves, penalty, 10 men, and then that's it. The whole game is conditioned from that. They equalised, but it was only a matter of time. They didn't really have the sharpness needed to sort of go on and take it. Now, I mean, look, they're still Colombia. James Rodriguez is probably going to start the next game. That's going to massively change them because they are so different when he plays. Mm-hmm. But they're going to miss Carlos Sanchez now. He's a very important player for them. How well is Davinson Sanchez going to recover from that mistake? You know, because it was a big mistake. You know, it's hard to see what happens. Honestly, Group H is up. I mean, I'd imagine Senegal will probably win the group now, to be honest, because they've got the win against Japan. That's a big win. You know, Poland. Yeah. They're going to play Japan next, I think. So
yeah, Japan next.
I suspect they'll beat Japan. I don't think Japan are that good, although Inui is very impressive, I thought. But they capitalise mostly on Colombia's sort of weakness. I don't think Senegal have that. They're very focused. They're very sharp. I think Senegal will top the group now, which means if England manage to top their group, yeah, it could be. I mean, it could be anyone. That's the thing. It could be any of those other three. I mean, who would you rather have if you're England? Probably Japan, because they look the kind of side that maybe England could physically bully. Poland. I mean, it'd be really boring, wouldn't it? Poland, because it'd just be two teams like trying to kick lumps out of each other. And Colombia is an X factor. You don't really want Colombia because it's an X factor. If you're England, anyway,
yeah, definitely want to avoid.
Because you know, I mean, yeah, sure, England could beat Colombia. Like the players aren't, you know, they have. But then also, Colombia could beat England. Colombia could come alive. James Rodriguez. Definitely. No one in England could live with that guy. You know.
And Sam, it's obviously arguably the most open group now, because it's not quite gone as everyone expected. Is it? How do you see it shaping up? And who would you like to see England take on or avoid?
Yeah, so I mean, the second round of games, Poland-Colombia, that's going to be really interesting now, because it's do or die for both teams. Yeah. So they're both going to be going full-blooded for it. I mean, I think if I had to pick a team to play, like Mo said, I think I'd go for Japan, but they're all around the same sort of level.
Which team's strength would you rather face, isn't it? It's like, would you rather face Japan's counter-attacking, skillful players? Would you rather face Colombia's just X factor of genius, or would you rather slug it out with Poland? You know, what would you rather do? I mean, it's pick your poison, I suppose.
Absolutely, certainly very open in Group H, Ed. I don't know if you've got any prizes for that, or how you see it going personally.
No, well, I'd concur with a lot of that. Certainly, if the game was England Poland, our goals price would be pretty low.
Yeah.
I think we'd probably be hovering around the 2 mark, mm-hmm. 2.1, 2.3, something like that, because, yeah, that looks like an arm wrestle. England-Colombia would probably be something like 2.7, 2.9.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's the sort of the difference we're looking at in terms of flair and ability. And England obviously set up differently, but I think if they played Japan or Poland, they'd be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Even Senegal wouldn't be. I think Colombia's the one probably. It's a sort of matchup that England have struggled with in the past.
I think Senegal would be a big problem for England because Senegal play the same formation, and England don't play well against teams that play the same formation as them. Teams that match up shape
as we saw against Nigeria.
Yeah, I think Senegal would be a real problem.
I mean, I think Senegal were deeply flattered because I thought Poland were so poor.
Yeah, that's true.
So, but they had nothing. They had no energy, no spark, no inventiveness, and they didn't even have a bit of fight when they had to. You know, in the last 20, you think you've got to find something here. Okay, they got a goal, but it didn't look like they were going to do anything about it. So I think they have to really turn things around because, you know, someone said to me in the office, it looks like they're frozen on the big stage. Mm. So there might be a reaction there, but...
I mean, they lost their nerve in Euro 2016, didn't they? They should have done really well there. They lost their nerve against Portugal. So, I mean, I'm not going to write them off. It's too early to do that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they don't get a point in this group.
Absolutely. So there's lots to play for in Group H and all the other groups, and we look forward to seeing how it pans out in the next couple of weeks. Okay, a few other talking points that have come up during the World Cup. First of all, VAR, obviously heavily discussed in football across sort of all leagues, but it's coming in the World Cup.
Yeah.
Mo, would you say it's been a success so far? Because I think there's been 10 penalties across the first 16 games. So a lot of penalties, a lot of decisions.
Yeah.
VAR, successful so far or not?
I mean, in the sense that the calls are now being done correctly, yeah, VAR has been a success. Obviously, it's worked much smoother than it has done in the past. It's worked by and large more efficiently. I mean, obviously they missed the Portugal penalty, which was a clear dive, didn't get that, and a couple of other ones, and you know, Harry Kane getting rock bottom to the ground in Tunisia, you know, so they missed a couple of big decisions that should have been penalties. But when it comes to you know, adjudicating was this a goal, like, they seem to need to work a bit on making the call themselves, but when something was happening, they have to judge was it right or was it not right. They're good at doing that, but I'm not a fan of it. I'm still not a fan, even though it's working correctly, because honestly, it slows the game down at the moment when you want it to be at its fastest. When a goal is scored, you just want to lose your, you know, 4-star word, and you can't, because it's like, wait, is it going to be allowed? And it's like, you can see it in the atmosphere, they score a goal, and it's like, and even the commentators are like, and the ref's going to check for VAR, and it's just like, it's completely and utterly underwhelming. It cuts the momentum off of them.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that, but cricket, rugby, American football, they're things I watch all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The last 5 years, it's been like that. A try is scored. Yeah. You can't celebrate. You have to check, was it foot in touch?
Yeah.
You go back 3 or 4 phases in rugby union now to see if there was a slight knock on.
Mm.
It's not just the actual act of scoring. So I think this is just the tip of the iceberg for VAR. You see in cricket as well, test wicket, you go up.
Yeah.
You can't celebrate.
You can't quite celebrate,
Is it, has he overstepped? Is it missing? Is it a bad call? Mm. But I think once you've dipped your toe in the water... you have to. I think with the contact situation where you're looking at the ball, the VAR is working brilliantly because you can see now, does he get the, you know, does he get the touch on it? The off the ball stuff, that's where I think VAR will have to expand, the Harry Kane stuff.
Mm.
So you'll probably get to the point where you have two different units looking at where the ball is and then stuff that's happening off the ball, particularly free kicks and stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's just a case of getting used to it because. Now you know you're getting decisions right. I don't think you can turn the clock back on this.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. It's really annoying because it's football. I watch American football too. Or I used to before the whole Happenex thing happened. But you know, it very stop start. It kind of just robs the game of the momentum. Like touchdown. Wait, they're going to review it, and it's like these guys just stand over a TV screen for like 5 minutes. Oh, and you know, and then they invariably come up with like the weirdest definition of what a catch is. And then, you know, NBA as well, it slows that down, although they don't review us so much in that. But football is a faster sport than them. Football is constantly in motion. It's not a stop-start game like the NFL, like even like rugby, which, I mean, rugby still is very free-flowing, but they're more staccato than football. Football is the most open and flowing sport there is, really, in terms of the major sports. And it just feels so unnatural, because at the moment when all the energy and momentum is punctuated by a goal and you should be celebrating, you have like a minute to just go crazy and bananas, and you can't. You're just like, it's sort of like, is it? Yeah, okay. And then you finally do celebrate, and it's still nice, but it's not the same. And I mean, I can only imagine how, I mean, I don't gamble, but I can only imagine how people who are gambling and betting a fair amount of money on, is there going to be more goals, or is this guy going to score? And then suddenly, you know, I bet like 50 quid on Harry Kane scoring an over a kick. Scores an over a kick. Oh, and you can't. So, oh, is it going to be allowed? And you know, how do you not just jump for joy when he scores that kind of goal? You know,
it is frustrating, but then I think ultimately, if the right calls are being made, then it's sort of a price that we're going to have to pay. Because I mean, I think at the moment VAR, what people are annoyed about with it is that there's still so much confusion. Like when, especially when you're watching on TV, and it's sort of, oh, we're being told that they're checking on VAR. It's the sort of the time frame of how long they look at it for, what they're actually looking at. As a sort of viewer on the TV, it's difficult. It must be a nightmare in the stadium. You wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah, I don't think they quite have worked it out properly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's still in terms of communicating to the stadium and to the TV. I mean, I think TV producers are trying to work out, what do we tell the people at home?
Yeah.
We're going to have everything flashing up when, you know, like a warning sign, like VAR is possibly in operation here. But again, these are teething problems, and I think it's just a cultural change that we'll just have to get used to.
It was interesting. I saw Gary Neville tweet. Obviously, we've seen lots of shots of the guys in the studio in their sort of full kit. But Gary Neville basically said that, you know, at Sky they have sort of dozens of people who are watching the angles to sort of get the right replays, and he sort of said that people don't appreciate how difficult it actually is to get the right angles up with that speed that we're expecting. It's not just, oh, give me a replay when it's an offside call. If it's a sort of penalty, they've got so many different camera angles and stuff. They need to focus on the right one, because I think a good example of one that frustrated a lot of people was the penalty that France were awarded when Griezmann was fouled by the Australian defender. Exactly, and that went to VAR, and people and they checked it, and then it's still subjective.
Yeah.
Everyone was still debating that decision, even though that play had been stopped for 2 minutes and it went through all the correct VAR, and half of the viewers were still saying that shouldn't have been a penalty.
Yeah.
It's never going to get rid of that subjective...
I was going to say
part of the game.
We need robot referees, mate. Boston Dynamics, get on it. Come on, give us a robot ref.
I think it was one of the arguments against it originally, but it was going to take debate out of the game, which it certainly hasn't done.
No, never will. And it hasn't in cricket, and it hasn't in rugby.
Yeah, that was always a facetious argument. It was debate would never go. It only gets like it says, it only gets, like, you just look at cricket debate. That was never, you know, that was never a wicket.
And now you retain your challenge if it's umpire's call.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In rugby, the ref asks, try yes or no, or any reason why I can't or would the try.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you can see something clear, the on-field decision will stand. So there's all sorts of stuff you can go down with.
And also the players are calling for VAR now aren't they?
I love that. That's so cool. Because I mean, I know people get really upset when players ask for yellow cards, but I think, mate, they're well within their rights to ask for yellow cards. If someone kicks you up in the sky, you want to be like, can you book this guy, please? So I love the fact that they're going, come on, VAR, VAR. Like, turns to the lines. Like,
you get booked for asking for VAR. That's probably the next thing.
Oh, mate, they better not do that. That's so cool.
Do you still get booked for doing the cards, it's not
explicitly in the Premier League but then
not in the,
in other leagues exactly. It's not really, they don't really care, because it's just like,
if you did in the Spanish league, there would be no players on the pitch.
Well, exactly. I mean correctly I think they just that, you know what I mean, it's if you're getting kicked up in the air and the referee isn't protecting you, you maybe you're well within your rights to say, hey, could you please protect me, book this guy. So I mean, I don't, it's this weird thing in England where we have, where it's like spitting and asking for a yellow card are worse than studs up tackles into someone's Achilles. You know, it doesn't make any sense, but that's just the way English football is, really.
I suppose with VAR, it's definitely here to stay, and then we suppose we've just got to get used to it. And I suppose it's quite strange that it's the biggest football stage of all, and there's teething problems, and they haven't quite worked it out yet. But I suppose they've just been
thrown into the deep end a little bit. Through, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, compared to what it was in domestically in England and in Italy last year, it's incredible. It's much better.
I agree.
I mean, just the leap from just the way Serie A constantly got made VAR mistakes, and in the, you know, the Carabao Cup, it wasn't exactly brilliant either. But I mean, like Ed says, it's just about teething problems, about getting better. Soon there'll be two sets of teams. I think that's absolutely the exact thing you want, because you want a team looking off the ball, you want a team looking on the ball. You sort that out, you've got eyes everywhere, and then you cut out mistakes. I'm still never going to be a fan, because like I said, it ruins momentum. But when it works, it's hard to argue against. It's hard to say, well, it makes it less fun. Yeah, but all the calls are being made correctly, so it's like, what do you want?
I think when it gets into the latter stage of the tournament as well, that's really when it's going to kind of come into its own. Because you think at the moment there's been a few sort of difficult goal line calls that we would probably be debating.
Yeah,
if because that's a given now.
Yeah,
in the latter stages when it's the matter of being eliminated.
Yeah,
or going through like that is when VAR is really going. Where you're going to see the benefits of it, and the next day after a game, we'll be saying, we would have been knocked out.
You're seeing it now, really. I mean, like Sweden, for instance, Korea would have got away with a draw against Sweden had they not been for VAR. So you know that Sweden will be like, thankfully for VAR. Although I'd like to add, goal line tech, I think is brilliant, absolutely perfect, and works flawlessly. But you know, VAR, it's just different because of the way it operates. It's
not black and white.
It's not instantly. But yeah, I think it's like Ed says. It's teething problems. It's here to stay. You can't go back now. You can't now. You've seen that. Okay, so there's been 10 penalties in the World Cup after one round of games. Like, you can't then go back to when these guys just aren't getting the calls. It's just not going to happen. This is the new football.
Absolutely. I think it's been pretty smooth so far, and hopefully that will continue, and hopefully a team won't get knocked out because the VAR has failed its duty. Hopefully that'll be the case. Just moving on, we talked about the penalties there's been in this World Cup. There's also been some cracking free kicks. I think there's been more scored at the 2018 World Cup 4 than in 2014, which was just 3.
Yeah.
So we've obviously had Ronaldo's one, Kolarov, Quintero and Golovkin. Anyone got a particular favourite? Mo, have you got all of those? Obviously, Ronaldo's the one that everyone's talking about.
I think Kolarov was technically the best, but it's got to be Cristiano, hasn't it? Come on, it's a lot. What was it, 88th minute against the best team in the world, and his team are losing. He's up for a hat trick, and he does that. Come on, it's not even close. I mean, technically, yeah, I think Kolarov was the best. I think it's fantastic whip, curl, dip. I love the invention of Quintero's. That was nice. Although the keeper should have saved it. I think he didn't hit it hard enough under the ball. But it's Cristiano's by a million miles. It's not even close.
Sam, you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, the pressure of the situation, that you have to take that into account. It was, 46, 47 attempts he'd had, and he hadn't scored a free kick.
Yeah, in World Cups, yeah.
Well, they've obviously got the ball right, haven't they? Because was it last one or one? But
2010.
It was that ball that just took off like a... Did you have the...
The only guy that knew how to play that was Forlan. Everyone else was like, what do we do with this thing?
So they've made it heavy, which is good. But as the guy next to me in the office said, England don't have a dead ball specialist, so
Trippier was on them, wasn't he?
Picked the wrong tournament to, obviously, you know, maybe you want a guy on it to, you know, a Beckham or someone, but I don't know if we got that.
Just quickly, you mentioned the Ronaldo free kick, which obviously, in terms of the betting for that moment, because obviously Spain were 3-2 up, and then how did that change things in terms of the trading? Were people happy with Portugal equalising?
Yeah, it came so late. I mean, if you're looking at betting on the exchanges, Spain would have been 1.02, you know, pretty much done. There was that own goal in the Iran and Morocco game as well. Yes. That was 5 minutes into injury times as well. So you've got a lot of, you know, you've had some late shockers and stuff. I suppose the thing about spread betting is you can get out if you're happy with your profit with 5 minutes to go and you don't want late heartbreak. Yeah. You can just pay a slight premium to close your position and save
Spain
your profit.
Spain backers could have done that.
Spain backers could have done, you know, as Ronaldo's lining up the free kick, you could have closed that.
To be honest, I would have done.
And then you'd feel wonderful when this goes in. You think, well, I've won anyway.
You absolutely would have been like, okay, I'm cashing out right now. You would not have won it because
focus on his face.
It was just one of those things. You're like, he's going to score this, isn't he? It was a dumb free kick to give away. It was last minute, and like I said, Spain had been so good, but you're thinking, yeah, this guy's going to hate this, isn't he? This is going.
I think what capped it off was when Danny Murphy said, No, he can't go around the wall.
Yeah,
there's something about those moments when someone just immediately proves the commentator wrong.
Yeah, you're just like, come on. Also, I can't. It's Cristiano Ronaldo. What do you mean he can't? I mean, come on.
I mean, don't tell him he can't do anything.
Yeah, well, exactly. You tell him he can't do anything, he'll go master it and then come back and do it.
Particularly against Spain as well. His employees.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
In a roundabout.
Who the Spanish government was. They fined him 80 million quid. And then later in the day, he bangs a hat-trick against them.
That was fascinating. The mental strength or channeling the anger.
Go on, have that then.
He can obviously afford it, but...
Just looking at just the free kicks, we did a poll on Scorker's Twitter account for the free kicks. Ronaldo was 54%, came out on top. Then Kolarov, 31%.
Yeah.
Then we got Quintero, 10%, and Golovin, 5%. So as expected, I would say
it's kind of harsh on Golovin because it was a really nice free kick, but it's like it just got overshadowed by every other free kick.
Absolutely,
but it was a nice way to cap off the opening game, I thought.
And I'm sure there'll be hopefully some more free kicks, some more goals, and lots to talk about in the coming weeks. Okay, as always, we're going to finish with some listeners' questions. Thank you for sending them in. We're going to start with one from Dean Smith. This is for Mo. Why do we not see the Man City Sterling for England? His form has obviously been incredible as they won the Premier League. But yeah. One game to the World Cup, he's been written off again. Is it a tactical thing, a confidence thing, or what goes on with Sterling for club and country?
Well, he's not managed by Pep Guardiola, which is the first thing. I love Gareth Southgate, but he's not the best manager in the world. Secondly, England don't play 4-3-3 with Sterling on the wing with a sort of free role to go wide and come inside. England play 3-5-2 with Raheem Sterling playing as a number 10. It's a completely different role. It's not the same at all. I know he can play the role that he's playing. He played false nine for Man City and done it very well, bar the finishing. But when he's in a central role, the first thing is, it's a more crowded area, right? Because he's there, and then Dele's coming forward, then Jesse Lingard's coming forward, and it's all about, and then Kane's there as well. And Kane doesn't push up and stay forward, Kane comes deep. So it's like four guys in small amount of space. So it's not as much room for him. There's not as much room centrally anyway for anyone, because that's where your opponent puts all their defenders. So that in itself is one of the issues. That's probably the main issue. Kane isn't really the ideal partner for him in the sense that Kane is slow. He's very quick on the ball, Kane. Very good with passing. He's an excellent player, but he's physically slow. And I think Sterling would really work better with someone who is quick in there, because then they could have more sharp interchange of passes and more movement. Mm-hmm. And that Kane doesn't move in the sort of way that complements Sterling by stretching defenders. He comes deep and compresses things for Sterling. And it's mostly just about tactics. If England played the same kind of 4-3-3 with Sterling on an island as a wide player, very wide, isolated against the fullback with space to run, and then he comes in field from that position. He has a central midfielder behind him, a striker ahead of him, and they're spacing. Pep Guardiola's sides always space the field very well. England do not space the field anywhere near as well as they do. They still do it well. I'm not criticising. I think England are fantastic, but you want to get the best out of Sterling. You need to space the field and let him dribble. And if he can't do that, because I mean that's what I was saying when it was clear Dele was limping and hobbling. I was saying on Twitter, I was saying, don't take Dele off, but don't take him off for midfield. Take him off for Rashford. Put Rashford up front. Put Sterling in midfield, because I think starting in a deeper position, while it seems counterintuitive to play him as a central midfielder, I think with more room to move, more grass to run into, and more space to build up, I think he would be much better. Because then he would actually have time to play his sort of natural game, which is dribbling, which is going at opponents, which is unbalancing him with his great dribbling. But I think you play him that high in that sort of advanced number 10 role, it's tricky for him to get momentum, to get dribbling on the ball. He's mostly playing a sort of a kind of role he's not really suited for. If Kane wasn't there and he was playing false nine, that would be better. But it's just the role he's put into. It's not really the ideal role for him, but he's so talented, and if you can find him pockets of space where he can do damage. I know why Southgate plays in there. He makes the team better. But for him personally, you're not going to see Raheem Sterling at Man City until he starts playing in a position where he's the focus rather than the Kane and the team as a whole.
Absolutely. Sam.
I think it might have got in his head a bit as well, having played so well in that 4-3-3 for City and almost having it jammed into him that is why he's scoring so many goals. Now he finds himself not there. In the first time for a long time, I think that might just have taken that, you know, just that point of a second extra on the ball when he's clean for a goal. Because I mean, I certainly think that not scoring for 68 minutes doesn't mean that Raheem Sterling can't finish.
Yeah,
absolutely. And just on that note, actually, the next question is about England's finishing from, I'm going to get this name right, at Vioinme. Hopefully that's right. Are you concerned by England's lack of finishing, Kane aside? Sam, because obviously they had plenty of chances early on, and is it Kane or bust in terms of finishing, or is that a bit dramatic?
I wouldn't say concerned. I'd be concerned if we hadn't created the chances. In Sterling, Ali, Lingard, they can all finish. We know they can finish. They might not be extremely consistent, but I'd still fancy them all to score if they go clean through on goal. I don't see it as a big issue at all. Especially with Kane up top, we have a stone cold killer who's probably one of the best finishers in the game.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to harm our chances at all.
Because if Kane was out of form, this would be a bigger issue. But he's playing in form.
Two shots, two goals.
Yeah, exactly.
But even if he's out of form, I'd still back Kane to score. Mm-hmm. And on that,
it's not August, is it? The World Cup isn't in August. Yeah. it's all right, isn't it? That's the thing.
On that quickly, on Kane's second goal, I think that finish has not been talked about enough. I don't know how many times the guy's been doing neck day in the gym, but it was literally Unbelievable.
He's got necks like the Rock. Like, you know, just
after being rock bottom, these.
Well, there you go. He's the people's champ.
Love it. Like, Harry Kane, the people's champion.
I mean, look, it was. I totally agree with that. I mean, Lingard, on the thing is, all his finishes, right, that he missed, three, right? Could have had a hat trick. All three of them, you'd think, yeah, you'd back him to score them on a regular basis. He scored goals like that on a regular basis. So the only worry is Sterling's finishing. And honestly, I think once he gets one, that's it. The monkey will be off his back and he'll be absolutely fine because he's a phenomenal footballer. I mean, what is it, 20-something, 24 goals this season, 23 goals this season? Yeah. 22%-ish shot conversion rate in the Premier League, which is the same thing, the same as Aguero's. So it's not that he's a bad finisher. He just needs the confidence to do it. One goal, he'll be absolutely fine.
I think it's just gets so over-amplified at the World Cup. If Lingard had missed those chances for Man United, then yeah, we'd have said he had a bad game, but we wouldn't all be saying, oh, drop him, he can't finish. It's one game. Yeah, we need them to deliver here and now, but I don't see it as a major problem now.
Absolutely. And the final question is from Phil Lowe. I'll go to Ed for this one. How far do you think Russia can go after their superb start? Obviously, 8 goals in 2 games, coming out the blocks, the hosts. Do you think they'll go far, and are they being backed to go too far?
Yeah, well, I mean, in fixed odds terms, they've gone from 100-1 pre-tournament, 66-1, and they're into about 40s now. But they do probably face Spain or Portugal in the next. But you know what? It used to be the case that hosts would massively overperform. Going back years, Sweden in 58, I think, got to the final against Brazil, and they were by no means fancy. England 66, Germany 74, Argentina 78. It used to be, these are big sides. But there's an element of being at home, the energy. Obviously, the Russian team are particularly proud, patriotic. Mm-hmm. There's a real sense of nationhood amongst them. That who knows what that's going to do. And Spain and Portugal have looked vulnerable. You get a momentum, you just don't know. I can see them really getting to the semis, something like that.
That would be massive, wouldn't it?
I think they'll win the group purely because I don't think... Well, actually, no, it depends on Uruguay, how many goals Uruguay... Actually, no, you know what? They won't win the group. But actually, Uruguay have to play Saudi Arabia. Look, they'll get out of the group. They're done now. Egypt, they beat Egypt and they got quite out of the group. But they will... They could, with a lot of luck, they could beat Portugal. But, I mean, honestly, Ignatievich against Cristiano Ronaldo, I mean... Come on, no. And against Spain, I mean, if they saw the ball, they'd be lucky. Russia are not a good team. They're better than their ranking showed because they haven't played any competitive games.
Yeah, that's right. They're lowest ranked, weren't they?
Yeah, but even their ELO ranking is not good either. They're not a great side, right?
No, on paper, you can't make a case for them, but the alchemy of the tournament is the only thing, I think.
I mean, it carries South Korea, but I mean, South Korea also got a lot of luck with refs. Yeah. Now, if Russia get luck with refs,
which I think they will.
I think they will.
You know, home nation.
Yeah, home nation. I mean, we'll see.
But Putin's little gifts.
It would need Portugal or Spain to just absolutely. That's the thing. If they had an easier round of 16 game, like if they're playing someone from Group H, for instance, you could say, all right, maybe momentum could carry them. But they're going to have to play one of Portugal or Spain, and that's where they're going to need such a massive heap of luck to get past either of those sides. Like, unless something incredible happens with Portugal and Morocco or Iran make it out of the group, I just can't see Russia getting past Portugal or Spain. Like, it's their bad fortune. Even with all the luck, all the win in the world, it's too big of a hill to climb. Spain are the best team in the tournament, and Portugal have the best goal scorer in the world. It's like, it's a bit too big of an ask, I think. But, we'll see.
Even if they run one of those two teams closer, that's still got to go down as a big success for Russia.
Incredible,
considering everyone was sort of saying they're the worst host nation ever, going to go straight out of the group.
And,
they've scored so many goals.
In theory, hasn't it already been a success? Like, the way they've those first two
games... They've got to get out of the group first. They've got to get out of the group. Once they get out of the group, then it's... But you know what, as well? I agree with Sam, because I think as well, not just have they been good and they're not disappointed as hosts, they've not been poor... They've also got some very good young players, man. Golovin is serious business.
Yeah, he could get the mention of a big
Cheryshev, it's not young, he's 26 or 27 now, but, Russia have always had, these really sort of interesting flair players, but they just sort of, somehow they all just managed to collapse at the same time before this World Cup, Arshavin fell to pieces, Zhagoev never materialised, but, Golovin is the real deal, and if they can just find some young defenders from somewhere, because the defenders are so old, they could have a decent side going into Euro 2020. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
And there is a chance they could end up playing Iran.
Yeah.
It's not... We're presuming it's Spain and Portugal. Morocco or Iran could kind of still muddy that water. So if that happens, the price just collapses on Russia, you know.
I can only imagine. If they pay Iran, they'll walk. If they pay anyone but Spain and Portugal, they'll walk it, because their momentum is off the charts right now. But I just think the quality, the jump in quality between Russia, even with momentum, and Spain and Portugal is just a bit too high. But I mean, look, I mean, I'm not a gambling man, but you know, it might be worth taking a punt on them if they do draw Spain or Portugal, because I mean, like Ed says, alchemy of being the host nation, you just never know.
It is a shame, really, that they're going to play someone so good, because that they would have a real chance. Like, from an England perspective, I certainly wouldn't be picking to play Russia after seeing them in those first two games and with the crowd behind them. So, I mean, yeah.
It'd certainly be interesting to see how Russia do. I think that's just about all we've got time for today on the Squawker Talker. Thanks to Mo, as always.
Thanks to you, mate.
And thanks to Sam.
Cheers.
And thanks to Ed to Sport and Index. Thanks for coming in, mate.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
We'll speak to you next time. Thank you very much.